Hebrews 10:22 says, and you can listen and write and pass and collect and everything. Hebrews 22 says, let us draw near to God with a true heart and full assurance of faith. The next way in the pathway of holiness is to regain your boldness. And Hebrews 10:22 says, we can draw near to God with full assurance of faith. What does that mean? If Jesus died in my place, if he already paid the price for all my sins, he loves me so much that there is no sin that I can do to make him love me any less. And there's no amount of Bible reading I can do to make him love me any more. This is not a performance thing. Okay, is everybody yeah, they're collecting, good. So get those, and we're collecting them, and thank you for doing that. But next, and here's the last thing before we go to the next chapter. If you've never noted Romans 6, I want to show you something. And I know you're either going to study or have studied Romans, but the key to understanding Romans as far as in our personal lives is that in chapter 6 of Romans, verse 11, is the very first imperative in the book of Romans. Does anybody know what an imperative is? Yeah, it's a command. In Greek, it's not a command because it's in bold or underlined or because you raise your voice. Most people know a command is they say, stop that. That's a command in English. It's shown to be a command by our inflection, our voice, bold, caps, underlined. In Greek, it's just a eta, tau, epsilon ending. It's three little letters. Jesus said, go into all the world and preach the gospel and teach them to observe all things that I have commanded. How would you know what Jesus commanded? In the Greek language, it's an imperative. So, verse 11 is the first imperative in the book of Romans. There is not a single command in Romans 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or chapter 6, 1 through 10. But look what it says in verse 11. Likewise, therefore, reckon. Do you know what command means? You have to respond to it. Yes or no? If I say, stand up, you respond yes by doing it. That was rhetorical. Oh, we have a very responsive young man there. That's why he has a red hood. But if I say rhetorically stand up, you have an instant choice, yes or no. When the Bible has an imperative, either we respond by doing it or by neglecting it as saying no. So what this says is reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to sin. So we need to renew our consecration. Christ died. And when he died, he opened the prison door to whatever sins we're captured by. He took our shackles off. He opened the door and he says, you can walk out. But if we stay in the cell, even though the shackles are unlocked and our chains are loosened, if we still sit there, it's kind of what they do to elephants. Did you know when elephants are little, they tie them with a huge rope that proportionate to their size, you know, it's like a 3-inch rope, and they'll put it around a little tiny baby elephant's foot, and they put this massive spike in the ground, and the elephant will go like this, and it's a little tiny elephant, and it can't pull that three-inch thick rope and the stake. And they leave it on for weeks and months. And the elephant grows into this 25-ton pachyderm, and they reduce the rope size down to just a dog leash. But the elephant has believed for so long that it cannot pull that out. It doesn't. Did you know you and I have been set free from every sin? No sin has dominion over us anymore. But only if we reckon. What does reckon mean? It means you operate like you believe it's true. If I gave you a cash card and said it has $1,000 on it, if you believed me, you'd go use it. And you'd say, and what's my balance? And someone would say, well, you just bought a drink. You have $999.61 left. And you'd go, wow, that's reckoning. Believing it enough to act on it. Reckon yourselves dead to sin. Verse 12 has the second imperative, do not let sin reign. So I have to say no to sin. That's a command. If in that castle in Europe, if I had not said no, then I wouldn't be here today. I would have started a lifestyle of promiscuity that would have totally disqualified me from teaching the Bible. Say no to sin. Verse 13, do not present your members. If you have a propensity to use your tongue for slander, gossip, or lying, stop it. It says, break the pattern. Don't keep allowing your tongue or your eyes. When Bonnie and I lived in California, we used to walk every beach of California as regularly as possible, and this is how we did it. We got out of the car, and I just enjoyed the beach. I didn't know if they had clothes on or if they were wearing snowsuits. I couldn't see anything. Why? Because I decided that I could live in California, but I couldn't go to the beach because I don't want to fill my mind with pictures of someone else's wife. Because that's adultery to have anything attached of any desire for someone else's wife. Jesus said, if a man looks on a woman with desire, he commits adultery with her. So I didn't want that, so I just took my glasses off, which was a way that I did not present my eyes, verse 13, my members, as an instrument of unrighteousness. But the positive side, you notice these have been negative, but present yourselves to God. Say, Lord, I want to present my eyes for you, my tongue for you. That's the old story, you know. Take my hands and let them be. Take my life and let it be. It's presenting them back. Verse 16 says the same thing, another imperative, present yourselves, and verse 19 says the same. So that's the renewing the consecration. Okay, let's go to chapter 14, and chapter 14 is feel the compassion of Jesus, the underlining, the tide turns in the war for the planet, and basically what we see in chapter 14, if you look at it in your notes or in your Bible, I looked and behold a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000. This is the 144,000 witnesses. And what we see is Jesus offers them something, and that something is joy and security. Look at verse 1. They sang a new song before the throne. They were with him, and they are seen with the backdrop of the tribulation as totally safe, totally filled with joy in the midst of the tribulation because of their relationship with him. That's how we can go through life. In the world, we will have trouble, but while we're in the presence of the Lord, we have joy and security. And I remember when I used to smuggle Bibles, one time we got caught, and they put me in jail, in Albania, no less. And there is something amazing about knowing that even though I was in a jail cell, knowing that Christ was with me, and that was the one thing they couldn't take away from me. They took everything else away from me, but they couldn't take Christ. And so we have joy and security. The next point is, if you notice on whatever page it is, Jesus offers purity in a sea of filth. Now, the reason I use that terminology is one of the writers of Roman history, not Herodotus, I don't know, I can't even remember which one, but one of the Roman historians said that Rome, the city of Rome, was like a cesspool. That's a septic tank. That's like an outhouse when you're at a, you know, an art show and you go to one of those stinky, that tank underneath. That's what Rome was like. It was filth. Jesus offers purity as we walk through a sea of filth. And the way he does that, you notice what it says in Revelation 14:3. These are the ones who are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. What is that talking about? We already went by. Do you remember chapter 9? I mean, that was like a long time ago, but when I read to you verses 20 and 21, it says, neither would they repent of their worship of demons or of their fornications. The pornified world we live in is making people insatiably hungry for sexual immorality. And that is going to lead to a world that Genesis 6 says, before the flood, every imagination of their heart was only evil continually. That's the flood, Genesis 6. It's going to be like that at the end. And these stand out. Jesus actually can keep us pure even if we live in a sea of filth. And that's the lesson, and you can read about that he's offering them. He also offers them, if you go further in your notes, he offers them joy and security. Ezekiel 8:9, by the way, those references I told you about, that's seeing the the imaginations, and I already gave you Hebrews 9. But Jesus also offers truth in a world of lies. And on their mouth, verse 5 says, there was no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. In other words, they had embraced truth. You know, it says in Ephesians that we're supposed to speak truth in love. They had, these 144,000, had decided that they were going to stand for truth and speak truth. And also, Jesus offers, and if you go further down in your notes, hope in the land of doom. I could tell you a story with every one of these. Did you know we are supposed to be the most hope-filled people in the world? Did I tell you the story about the cocaine addict that came up to us at breakfast that had, he was a coke snorter? Does anybody remember that? I probably didn't tell it. Bonnie and I, my wonderful wife, we used to go out to breakfast every day at the same place. It was one of those diner things like they have all around us here in New York. And we would go, and on our way to work, before we had children, we'd go to the same place every day. And it was in Los Angeles, downtown at 9th and Figueroa. And we had this coke head, a coke addict. The way you know a cocaine addict is their nostrils are about this big around, because they snort cocaine up, which enlarges your capillary veins, and it actually enlarges your nose so that your nose looks like two large garage doors. It's unbelievable, and all red and puffy, and that's a sign of coke snorters. Well, this guy was a coke snorter. He was always sniffling, and you know, you could tell he was just coming off of or going on to his next snort. And, you know, that's how it was in Los Angeles, so we didn't pay much attention to it. But we would sit there every morning at breakfast and read the Bible to each other while we were eating our eggs and potatoes before we went to work. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of the same restaurant every day, we were reading our Bibles when all of a sudden our waiter came and he leaned down like this so he could get low enough to look up in our eyes, and he went like that and looked up at me and he said, "Hey, man, what are you on?" He said, "I'm a coke head." He said, "But you two are high every morning." And he said, "What drug do you use?" Because he says, "I can't stay high." What was he describing? The hope we had in the Lord. His feeling like he had purpose came from cocaine. We had the Holy Spirit living within us. The only way he knew you got that feeling was through drugs. And so he thought we had discovered a new type of drug that lasted longer. And so we were able to share with him the gospel. Now, do people think that you are taking something because you have so much hope and joy and peace? When the church started, they said that they were drunk at 9 a.m. That's how they described the day of Pentecost, the joy the Holy Spirit brought. They said, "These men have been drunk." And they said, "No, it's not drunkenness, it's the Holy Spirit." That's what Jesus offers to us. He also offers, if you go down a little bit further, compassion. What is the most frequent emotion of Christ? I write it down for you right there. The most frequently described emotion of Christ is compassion. And I have it for you. He had compassion for the confused. He had compassion for the sick and suffering. When Jesus' emotions are noted, most often the Word of God says Jesus was splanknoi. That's the Greek word. In the ancient world, they felt the seat of feelings was right here. You know, when you go on a roller coaster ride or someone's driving over a little dip in the road and you go, you feel that right here? That's where they felt your feelings were centered. What do we say? "I love you with all my heart." So where has the center of feelings moved to? Heart. Where did the Romans say? Splanknoi, intestines. So that means if on Valentine's Day, in our time, if you really love someone, you give them a chocolate what? Heart. But in the time of the Bible, if you really love someone, you gave them chocolate intestines. Think of that. You know, can you imagine passing out a box of intestines? But that is the word for that feeling that we say is in our heart was splanknoi, and that's the word. Jesus was moved with compassion, and he had compassion for the weak. So anytime you and I are weak, he feels for us, for the suffering, for the desperate, for the persistent, for the hopeless, the bereaved, the misfortunate, and most of all with the repentant. You can keep reading the doom of life without Jesus, and then Jesus offered to them understanding in the time of wrath. And that's one thing about Christ. It says in Revelation 14, I looked and behold in a white cloud, and the cloud sat one like the Son of Man. And Jesus is serenely sitting in glorious power, and then he pours out his wrath. After that, how do you develop compassion as Christ's servant? And I give you several points on that, but we must move on to Revelation 15. And I was talking with Mark Strout, and I said, why is it that the guy that teaches Revelation 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 has only 5 chapters to cover, and he gets the same amount of time as me, who has 17 chapters to cover? So I'm lodging a little protest. That's why it's hard to follow, because I have to cover 17 chapters. Let's meditate on the beauty of Jesus, and I reference for you slowing down to see Jesus. Most of us are going too fast in life. We're at hyperspeed. And so the reference in your notes is, be still and know that I am God. And there's something about slowing down. I give you a poem. We have taller buildings and shorter tempers, wider freeways but narrower viewpoints, bigger houses with smaller families. Halfway down, we've learned to rush but not to wait. We have higher incomes but lower morals. And the very last line, it's a time when there is much in the show window and nothing in the stock room. A time when technology can bring the universe to our screens, but the God of the universe can't bring us to our knees. We're very distracted. And it takes time to slow down to see Jesus. So that's what the 15th chapter is about. The seven bowls of wrath, and I'll give you an overview graphically of this. We have the first bowl, which is the sores poured out. Then we have the second bowl, which is the sea of blood, and the third bowl, the rivers and the waters, and the fourth bowl, the sun scorches. Did you all know that there's a solar cycle, and we're right in the middle of another round of it? It's an 11-year cycle, and then there's a 400-year cycle, and scientists have tracked it for years. They track it through the growth rings of trees. They're always taking core samples, and what they found is that globally there seems to be a 400-year cycle of the sun and an 11-year cycle of solar storms and sunspots. Right now, if you looked at the sun with protective gear, you would see not a single black dot. There are no sunspots right now. None. That's rare. Why? Why is that? Why does it even matter? Who cares what the sun's doing? Because sunspots explode on the surface like all of our atomic weapons times 1,000. Each sunspot is so powerful that it blasts this magnetic energy toward the Earth, and when it hits our ionosphere, it actually warms up the Earth a little more than normal. Normal sunlight keeps us at a constant seasonal temperature. Solar storms cause this extra heating. When there's no solar storms, the sunlight coming from the Earth gradually isn't enough to keep our temperatures as high. Why do I say that? Because you ever heard of a Stradivarius violin? Do you know what makes a Stradivarius very special? The wood it's made of. And when they examined the wood of those violins that were made 400 years ago, the wood has a denser, it's denser wood because it was colder. In fact, the canals of Amsterdam froze. Venice's canals froze. The Mediterranean froze in the 1600s in Venice because it's called the Maunder Minimum, where the sunspots go down. And so there's this solar cycle that God has built in. But right here, he pours the other. He blasts the sunspots so the earth warms up and everyone gets scorched. Darkness, kind of like being in a cave, hits the earth. And then the Euphrates gets dried up and the kings of the east come across. And then we have this three demon spirits come out, kind of like an unholy trinity. And these demons are demons that are kept in the pit that are very powerful deceivers. And those three alone can go out and mobilize the whole world. They are so alluring. They're kind of like the sirens. And then the seventh seal is, it's done, the Lord says. And he starts the final culmination. Now, you notice, I want you to see this, that the trumpets we saw in chapter 7 and 8 are very parallel with these bowls. But the trumpets were only thirds, a third of the sun, a third of the waters, a third of the whatever. These are global. And so now everything's ramped up. And I just wanted you to realize that that this is when the real tribulation hits. Okay, Jesus Christ is patient. You can see that in your notes, that fill in the blank. In Ephesians 4 and the book of Daniel, it talks about how the Lord is patient with us and is waiting. And the saints, if you keep going down in your notes, Jesus' saints are triumphant. I cite for you Revelation 15:3. I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who have the victory over the beast, over his image and over his mark, and the number of them were the number of his name were standing in the sea of glass. This is the beginning of seeing all of these people who will not take the mark of the beast because they hear the testimony of the 144,000, they hear the preaching of the two witnesses. They do not take the mark, and they're immediately executed. Now, let me ask you, how are they executed? How does the book of Revelation say that the Antichrist kills them? By whatting them? Beheading them. How does he kill them? By what? What is the chief of militant Islam? What is their chief way of killing people? What is the beast the head of? The revived what empire? Roman. You guys remember that? The image that Daniel saw had two legs, and it was the Roman Empire, and then the revived Roman Empire is the 2 feet and the 10 toes. If you look at a map of the Roman Empire today, the Roman Empire circled the Mediterranean, and it went into the Middle East. The largest part of the Roman Empire was what we call Turkey today. The next largest part is what we would call Syria today. And the next largest part would be what we would call Egypt today, and Algeria, and Libya, and Tunisia, and Morocco. Those were, outside of Italy, Northern Africa, the Middle East, and Turkey were the most flourishing parts of the Roman Empire. They only controlled part of Spain, part of France, part of Germany. You ever watch Gladiator? Those were the Germans not accepting the Romans, and they fought. So the Roman Empire was primarily the coastal area of what we would call the Riviera, and up the coast into France and half of Britain, but all of Northern Africa, Turkey, and the Middle East. Now, that's 2,000 years ago. What dominates what I just described? What's all of Northern Africa dominated by? Islam. What's the Middle East dominated by, except for the little postage stamp New Jersey sized Israel? Islam. What's Turkey? Islam. What just migrated to Europe? 2 million Islamic people. The revived Roman Empire is a geographic area, which in the first century was Roman. In our century, it's becoming Islamic. It's very possible that the revived Roman Empire will be very much Islamic, which would say why the Antichrist is cutting everybody's head off. Think of ISIS not as something that gets defeated in Syria, but something that takes over the world with a genius person leading it. And that person, the Antichrist. So that's what we're talking about. You know, don't think that everything's going to stay Western dominated. It's the geography that stays the same. It's not the political system. And then we see them singing the song of Jesus. And I go through right above where it says the song of Jesus. I'm quoting below it their song. But up above, I give you a list. There are many songs in Revelation. And they're really, I mean, if we're going to be in this endless pursuit seeking Christ, they're really wonderful to read and meditate on. The next point you need to fill in is that Jesus Christ is victorious. I looked and behold, it says in Revelation 15:5, the temple and the tabernacle of the testimony were open. And basically what we see there is, and you cannot understand the book of Revelation unless you understand how it's tied to the rest of the Bible. There are 404 verses in Revelation. There are over 800 quotations and allusions to the rest of the Bible. 400 verses with 800 allusions or quotations of the rest of the Bible. Most of the Old Testament images are drawn into the book of Revelation. Here's one of them. It says, behold, I saw this tabernacle of the testimony. That's Revelation 15:5. What was the tabernacle for? Look in your notes. It was the way to the presence of God. If in the Old Testament you wanted to come to God, you had to come to the tabernacle. It was a visible representation of how to find God. And it was a way of accessing him. And by the way, that's what Jesus is. Jesus is God with us. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. It was a way of guidance, the way of forgiveness. You can read all that. See, the book of Revelation uses all those Old Testament images to show us how wonderful Christ is. And if nothing else, if you don't, can you in your Logos or whatever you're using highlight stuff? I would highlight, my favorite part of this whole thing I'm teaching you is that Jesus is the way of the presence of God, in your notes. Jesus is God with us. He's the invisible God. He's the one who is our cleansing. He wants to guide us. He promised us his care. He has opened the way for us. And he alone offers an overflowing life. Did I tell you about when I met the Shah of Iran's daughter yet? Did anybody know who the Shah of Iran is? Have you ever heard of Iran? Yeah, you know, the big country? Before they took it over with the Islamic overthrow, they used to have a king who was called the Shah. He was almost the wealthiest man in the world because he owned Iran and all their oil, which is a lot. And he was called the Shah of Iran. And during the Reagan times, he was, and before, well, especially before, he was one of America's biggest allies. The Shah of Iran was very pro-Western, and he basically sucked all the wealth of Iran. And so Bonnie and I were once, between having children, she was 6 months along, and I said, honey, we need to go backpacking in Europe. That was with our third or fourth child. I said, you just need to get away from everything, and here's my plan, honey. We'll have my mom and dad take care of our kids, and we'll pack a backpack, and we will sleep on the trains, and then tour all day long. And it'll save money. We don't have to have a hotel. We'll sleep on the trains and tour all day. We will buy bread and cheese and eat it and bottled water and have a wonderful time. And she's going, sounds really good. You know, 6 months along. And so the third day of this glorious trip, we're training all over, and the train hit a little bump. And I woke up at 3 a.m. and I opened my eyes and I looked, and there's Bonnie sitting looking out the window of the train. And I said, honey, you're supposed to be sleeping now. We sleep on the trains and we tour during the day. She said, honey, I haven't slept the whole trip. She said, you can't find it comfortable. When you're 6 months along expecting a baby, she says, everything aches and nothing is comfortable. And she said, I can't find a place to sit. She says, I haven't slept yet. I said, oh, so this isn't an exciting trip. She said, well, it is for you, but not for me. So I said, next train stop, we're getting out and we're getting a hotel. And so we got out and we were in Neuschwanstein, crossing the Alps. That's where the Disney castle, the real one that they modeled in the center of Disneyland and World, that castle is a real place. Neuschwanstein is called. And so we were at the hotel at the foot of that castle. And so I said, we need a room, and we're going to eat because we'd only been eating bread and water and cheese. And so we went down to the dining room, and it was March, and it was totally empty. Nobody goes there in March. It's gray and overcast and rainy. And we sat in this dining room, facing the castle, and we had the most glorious time. We ate dinner for 2 hours, and we talked, and she was so looking forward to sleeping in a real bed and taking a shower, and we talked and laughed and shared, and we always read the Bible at our meal together and talk about it because it's such a blessing. And after 2 hours, I noticed that someone was walking toward us, but I thought, you know, there's so many tables, they're not wanting us. So I just kept talking with Bonnie and reading until finally they walked right to our table. And I looked down, and all I saw is white fur. I don't know what kind of animal has absolutely pure white fur, but that woman had killed several of them because she was wearing from her shoes right up to her shoulders an exquisitely white fur coat. But it didn't close. It was open in the front, and you could see her necklace that she was wearing over this other outfit she had on, and it had very large red, green, and clear stones. And all of a sudden, as I looked at them, if you've ever seen a real diamond, it almost looks like it's on fire. Light just it's fiery. And a real ruby, and a real, that's what she was wearing. She was wearing a necklace with the size of like an acorn, rubies and diamonds and emeralds. So I thought, they came up and they went, excuse me. And I thought, yes. And I looked up, and then I looked at her husband or whoever he was standing next to her. I had never seen a man dressed like that. He had real gold on every edge of his clothes. Gold foil all along this edge of his, right here on his collar, right here on his cuffs. That was just the start. I was having trouble talking. I'd never seen anybody wearing gold. I didn't know they could put gold on clothes. And so I said, yes, because he said, excuse me. I said, yes. He said, may we sit with you? And I looked, there were 40 tables. And they were standing at our little foretop. And I said, yes, if you want to. We had been on the train for 3 days. We hadn't taken a shower. I mean, I look like a grease ball. You know, I had my baseball cap on, hadn't shaved. You can't shave on the train. Bonnie, you know, was clipping her hair because, you know, it was really, we were far from presentable. And I thought, don't you want to sit somewhere else? We probably smell. And here, Miss Fur Coat and Clinking Emeralds and Mr. Gold Foil sat down at our table. I said, hello. Thank you for coming. They said, well, we've been sitting right over there behind that tree and have watched you for 2 hours. I said, I didn't know anybody else was in here. Did we do something wrong? They said, no. We have one question for you. We walked over here to ask you one question. Why are you so tranquil? They're from Strasbourg, and they didn't speak good English. Why are you so tranquil? Why do you have this overflowing, peace-filled life, is what they ask us. I said, before I answer that, could you tell me who you two are? I didn't quite catch who you were. He says, oh, my name is Hans Guggenbuhl. He says, I'm the head of the European Common Market Bank. I'm the chief banker of all of Europe. I said, oh, you're wearing some of the profits. I could tell that, the gold. And I said, and her? He said, oh, he says, that is my wife. He says, her name is Manisa Riza Shah Pahlavi. Now look that up in Wikipedia sometime. She was the Shah of Iran's daughter. She was the heir of the wealthiest man of oil money, more than the Saudis. That's why she was wearing those real stones. I said, ah, so the white thing is real. Yeah, that was a fur coat. So we sat, Bonnie and I, with our Bibles and shared the gospel. And the longer we talked, he said, my father was a Lutheran minister. And he talked about what it says in your notes there, that Jesus is the one that gives us this overflowing, I have come that they might have life and they might have it more abundantly. They were sitting there watching the abundant life of Christ. Even though we were grease balls, the abundant life of Christ still shined out. And they sat for 2 hours wondering how they could have what those two poor, dirty, greasy Americans had that those two uber-rich people had looked for their whole life. So at that time, I was on staff with John MacArthur, and I said, why don't you come to church with us? They said, where is it? I said, Los Angeles. They said, oh, we go to Santa Barbara all the time. The Shah's sister lives in Santa Barbara in a big compound. We'll come. And they came to church. The head of the Common Market Bank and the Shah of Iran's daughter. And what was amazing is they were so longing to know what Jesus gives to every single one of us in this room. Now, I'm just wondering, are you letting that life more abundant flow out of you so that others will see him? The next thing you need to fill in is Jesus Christ is wrathful. That's kind of an abrupt change. Well, look at verse 8. The temple was filled with smoke. And by the way, we warned them of the wrath of God to come. We shared the gospel. We corresponded. They never made a commitment to Christ. But you know what? That was one of the most unusual soul-winning things I ever had, to have those people listen to the gospel. But I told them about the wrath of God to come, and that's what this section is about. And then we have to rest. Finally, this chapter ends with resting in the beauty of Jesus, and it talks about how to worship the Lord. Okay, I'm going to continue because I'm exactly 37 minutes behind. I should take it from that other guy that's teaching 1 through 5. But let's go to the next chapter in your notes, and let's talk about Revelation 16, which is probably the one everybody knows about. Revelation 16 is what life is like without Christ. That's the whole purpose of the 16th chapter. Every wrathful judgment God pours out on the world is exactly the antithesis of what he offers to every Christian. In other words, what Jesus offers us, he gives the opposite to the earth dwellers. Now, let me show you what I mean. It's fascinating to watch this. Number one, if you're reading in your notes there, there are the bowls. Look at the bowls. First bowl, human bodies ooze with malignant sores. Everybody on earth gets a malignant, like, tumor oozing. I mean, that's bad. The second bowl, earth's oceans will become death washing up on every shore. The waters of the sea are filled with life and become the stench of dead blood. Again, garbage in the trash can not taken out. Think of that horrible smell, or when you're, you know, jogging and there's a dead raccoon that or deer and it's, oh, it makes you sick. The whole world is like that. The third bowl, all water on the planet will have the stench of corruption rising from every river, every stream, every well, and every faucet. Now, that's only the third. And the fourth one is people's bodies burn from a solar fire pouring down from the skies. It's like no amount of, protection with sunscreen can take what is coming. And then the fifth bowl is an instantaneous, impenetrable darkness. Bonnie and I went to Mammoth Caves once. That was when our sixth child was almost to be born, and I was so foolish to take her there. If you go to Mammoth Caves, it's 300 steps. I'm talking about in Kentucky. You go down all these steps, and of course they told Bonnie to go first because she was so obviously expecting our sixth child. And so they put her at the front of the line. She went all the way down the thing, and when you get to the bottom, there's this little narrow gate that you have to walk through into the cave. And Bonnie went, She couldn't get through, and there were 200 people all the way up the circular staircase, and she was 300 steps down and couldn't get through the little narrow entrance to the cave. I thought, why did I bring her here? So finally she went and pushed through, and that child has always had a little something wrong with him. No, not really. He actually is at UCLA and has a full scholarship. I think that helped him. But Bonnie is a trooper. But the reason I say that is, when we got into the cave, everyone didn't think they were going to get in. They had us all sit down. And then the ranger said, now it's only going to last a second, but I'm turning the lights out. No one thought anything of that until he did it. Within 5 seconds, it's so dark down there. There isn't a light source anywhere. You feel like you're in black ink. And people started going, and you could see them pushing their luminous things because they needed to feel that there was light, because they started feeling claustrophobic and almost, they were panicking. And so he turned and he said, I'm sorry, I only had the lights out for 10 seconds. And the whole world is going to go into this. They're going to be immersed in impenetrable darkness, which is another thing of what hell is like. The waters of the great river Euphrates dry up, and the people gather for the seventh bowl being the greatest earthquake. Now look at the next thing in your notes. Why did Jesus send those sores? Because Jesus is showing his sanctifying and life-giving powers. Jesus sanctifies us. He gives us life. He satisfies us. He liberates us. He enlightens us. And the whole tribulation bowls are exact opposites of what Jesus gives, and if you don't have him, what life would be like without him. The second thing is, we see Jesus has satisfying and life-giving powers. That is countering the malignant sores, and also the sanctifying power is that sea of death. And I talk about, do you know what? If everything dies in the sea, that means there's very little time left for people on earth, because most of our oxygen is from the plankton. And that renews the plankton over the oceans that cover 78% of the surface of the earth are sucking in the CO2 and pumping out oxygen. The forests are only a small part of what God is doing with the oceans when he designed all that, and it becomes a sea of death. Jesus also has liberating power. When the angel poured out his bowl on the rivers and everything, you can read that. The waters are poisoned. But Jesus has these satisfying power, like water satisfies us, liberating power. He sets us free from the things that destroy us in our life. You can read about the ultimate sunburn there and the liberating power. And then Jesus also has enlightening power. Remember, he said, I am the light of the world, but when the fifth angel pours out his bowl and it becomes dark, people realize how bad it is to not have light. And see, Luke says that the Christmas story says that Jesus came to those sitting in darkness and in the shadow of death. God pictures all of us before we're saved as blind, sitting in the dark on the edge of a pit. That's how we're born, headed for hell. And Jesus comes along as the light of the world. And everyone who will call out to him. Remember blind Bartimaeus saying, Jesus of Nazareth, have mercy on me. That's a picture of people crying out for salvation. And Jesus came and healed his eyes. You and I were born spiritually blind and in darkness, ready for the pit, and Jesus walks by. Now, how does he walk by? Primarily in this time we live, he walks by with us, talking to people at Starbucks, like Daniel, Mr. Pierce, that I told you about, talking to people like the couple sitting behind the tree that watch. He uses us to share the gospel and to call them from the darkness to the light. Now, he's working inside of them, but we're supposed to give the gospel, and that's his enlightening power. Keep going in your notes. Jesus has conquering power. Armageddon is showing these three evil spirits getting the whole world to march against God. Did you know it's showing that God can conquer, but if he isn't conquering, the devil is going to be busy, and you can read all that. I mean, Armageddon is very, very graphically described there. And finally, Jesus has securing power, and that massive earthquake is what happens when God allows the earth to start unhinging. Did you know they found another fault in California? Who is it from San Diego? I met someone from San Diego. There we go. Yay. Jeremiah is from San Diego. Just north of San Diego, they found a second rail of the San Andreas Fault. They don't just have the San Andreas. There's one they haven't even seen until last week, and they detected there is a double, just like a train track, going right up the ridge of our largest populated state with 40 million people, and it runs north to south, and it's going to be far worse than the Andreas movie with, you know, Dwayne Johnson or whoever was in it. And basically, that is God saying you don't have any security. Now, real quickly, let me show you what's going on in Armageddon graphically. This is, you know what this is. You guys are good geographers. My favorite place in the world is right there. I would live in Jerusalem if I could. You know, of course, Egypt and Cyprus and Crete, where Paul wrote Titus. Here is Asia Minor in the Bible, Turkey, and there's Greece. Athens is right there. Where's the Peloponnesus? I can't see. Corinth is over there somewhere. And here's the Tigris and Euphrates. Now watch what happens. This is Armageddon. First, the king of the south comes. What's that? That's all of the, all of the Islamic, they're going to confederate together all the Islamic militants, and they're going to come to destroy the people of God. Then the kings of the north, that's all of Russia and all of its other allies. Then the Antichrist comes from his headquarters in Western Europe toward the land of Israel. And then the kings of the east, which would probably be all the, the Chinese, of course, and the Koreans and the Japanese. And all of them are united in one thing. They want to stop God, and they want to support their leader, the Antichrist. Mount Megiddo is significant. That's why it's called Armageddon. So many things in the Bible happen there. It's 60 miles north of Jerusalem. That's where Jabin and Sisera and all that. Gideon was there. Samson triumphed over the Philistines south of there. Barak and Deborah fought Sisera there. Saul killed Philistines there. Mount Megiddo is huge in the Bible, and it's also the scene of the last war. But before we go to the next chapter, I want you to turn to Psalm 16:11 with me, and I have just a minute to share this with you. If you were 16 years old in our family, this is what I would share with you on your birthday. Remember I said for your 19th birthday that I would have done that, Martel. But Psalm 16 ends with this promise. David said, "You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are endless pleasures." God says, I want to be your guide. I would like to guide you through life. It's so hard to know what way to go. I'll be your guide. I will show you the path. Just follow me. As long as you follow me, I'm going to stay on the path. And if you follow me, you'll always be on the path of life. Do you want to know what God's will is? Follow Christ. He's walking that way. Jesus is walking God's will for your life. All you have to do is follow him. How do you know you're following him? In your presence is, what does the middle part of verse 11 say? In your presence is what? Fullness of joy. Thank you for saying that. If I hold up my cell phone and tap it and look, I can see how many bars I have or circles, how close I am to a cell tower. The closer I am to the cell tower, the stronger the signal is. The closer you are to Jesus Christ, the more full your life is with his joy. And so if you're really full of joy, you're really close, and when you start following him at a distance, you get less joyful until finally you feel very, very unjoyful. So the way you know you're following him is you're full of joy, and as long as you follow him, you're on the path. And then look what it says in verse 11 at the end. At your right hand are endless pleasures. You know what that means? If you live life at his right hand, means under his authority, the way he wants it to be. If you obey God, life is filled with endless pleasures. Doesn't mean it's not hard, doesn't mean it's not difficult, doesn't mean it's not challenging. It's endless pleasures. Marriage, as God designed it to be, is intoxicating. That's what it says in the book of Proverbs. It's like we're intoxicated.